Our gospel today is from the Gospel of John, the 6th chapter. After this, Jesus went to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, also called the Sea of Tiberias. A large crowd kept following him because they saw the signs that he was doing for the sick. Jesus went up the mountain and sat down there with his disciples. Now the Passover, the festival of the Jews, was near. When he looked up and saw a large crowd coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread for these people to eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he was going to do. Philip answered him, "6 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each of them to get a little." One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are they among so many people?" Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." Now there was a great deal of grass in the place. So they sat down, about 5,000 in all. Then Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated. So also the fish, as much as they wanted. When they were satisfied, he told the disciples, "Gather up the fragments left over, so that nothing may be lost." So they gathered them up, and from the fragments of the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten, they filled 12 baskets. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they began to say, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." When Jesus realized that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he withdrew again to the mountain by himself. This is the word of God for the people of God.
Thanks be to God indeed. Well, we talked to the kids a moment ago about names and about people whose names we don't know. If you go to Arlington, Virginia, to Arlington National Cemetery, you can find one of the most famous memorials to those who have served anywhere in the world. That's officially called by a name nobody uses, which is Tomb of the Unknowns. Of course, everyone else calls it the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, right? Now, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier has existed since just after World War I, when there was the remains of an unknown soldier was made aware by the President of the United States, and he elected to have the remains laid out in the Capitol Rotunda for the American people, essentially, to see, and then had them buried at Arlington National Cemetery with a simple stone that simply read, "Here lies the unknown soldier." Over time, that stone became a larger monument, and there was eventually a plan to build a giant building, but then you know, Congress changed their mind about the financing, and back and forth and back and forth to the state that it is today. And in that time, the same thing has happened again and again. Unknown soldiers from wars ranging from World War I, World War II, Vietnam, and so forth, have been brought, laid out to be displayed at the Capitol Rotunda, and then buried there at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. To this day, it has 24/7, 365 guards who have only been dismissed due to extreme weather a couple of times in the last several decades, and who, rain or shine, wear their wool uniforms and march in a very specific way. I discovered when I was reading about this that the soldiers who guard the unknown soldier's tomb spend 6 hours preparing the uniform, which includes a haircut every day. They get their hair cut every day. They check the uniform every day. The tolerances for the uniforms are 1/64 of an inch. That means every ribbon, every piece, every little bit is 1/64 of an inch. Some of the soldiers even weigh themselves every day and work very hard to make sure that no part of their body changes so that the uniform doesn't fit as perfectly as possible. They measure themselves daily and check themselves. It's incredible the work that they do. And it's one of the highest attrition rates in the Army in terms of applying for the job and getting it, because so few can pass the training. As it turns out, this was the one that really fascinated me. There's only one badge. Of course, when you're in the Army, you get a badge for your job. There's only one badge that's awarded less than the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier badge, and that's the astronaut badge. Literally, the only thing in the Army that's harder than becoming a guard of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier is becoming an astronaut. You know, so it's incredible how much effort and energy and work and pomp and circumstance we give to honoring those who served their country and died without ever leaving a name behind, and with good cause. The Bible is full of unknown people who do extraordinary things but never get so much as a name. We know them in the Bible simply as the leper or the woman or the Roman, for example. The Bible is full of these individuals who are everyday heroes. That's our series we're in right now, Everyday Heroes, talking about the ordinary people in the Bible who do really extraordinary things when God asks them to. And the Bible is full of these extraordinary heroes who were known simply by who they were and not what their name was. For example, today, in John's Gospel records, the youth, or the young boy, or the young man. Essentially, just a kid. That's all we know about him. We don't know where he's from. We don't know how old he is. He's young. We know that much. We don't know what he was doing. We don't know where he got the food. We just know him as the kid. We're continuing our series, Everyday Heroes, this morning, talking about normal, everyday people who are called by God to do extraordinary things. Today's story is one that's probably familiar to you if you've spent enough time around church. According to John's Gospel, Jesus had just learned that his close friend John the Baptist had died. If you recall, when Mary, pregnant with Jesus, walked into the presence of Elizabeth, who was pregnant with John the Baptist leapt in her womb. There was this connection even before birth. It was John the Baptist that Jesus sought out to baptize him. Nobody told him to go there. He sought John the Baptist out to baptize him. It was John the Baptist who was preaching this extraordinary message. In fact, a lot of scholars, most scholars, biblical scholars, agree that Jesus actually was influenced by John the Baptist, not just the other way around. In other words, Jesus actually took notes from what John the Baptist preached and used it in the way he preached as well. This is an extraordinarily important person in Jesus' life. Right? We know that Jesus died for people he'll never meet. Well, not until we're done here, right? We know that Jesus died for people he didn't know. We know these stories of his extraordinary sacrifice. So just how much must he love someone that he felt so dearly about like that? So John the Baptist is dead. He's been executed by the king, by King Herod. A variety of stories as to why, the most common, of course, being that his stepdaughter had asked for it. But as cool as John the Baptist is, we're not going to talk about him today. Today we're going to talk about somebody whose name we don't know. Because as Jesus hears about the death of John the Baptist, he decides it's time to retreat. Now, I am baffled by people who feel like they don't need time to rest or recharge after experiencing grief, or feel like they're ready to just jump back into things, but think that they're so much stronger even so than Jesus, who himself had to take a little bit of time off when he found out his friend had died. Jesus then, you know, is a very well-known individual at this point. He finds solace in the ocean, and he comes back to shore where a crowd is gathered. Now, this is a little bit tricky because as you read the four Gospels, you're going to find different accounts of what exactly transpired next, primarily differences in the number of people. Now, what's interesting is that theologians, as usual, try to come up with really complex solutions to this, ranging from this being actually two different miracles, the 4,000 and the 5,000, or to being issues of recollection. But, you know, my brain, which is not a seminary professor's brain, thinks maybe just nobody took a head count, and when they sat down to write it down, they came up with different ideas of how many people they guessed were there. Either way, John's Gospel writes 5,000. Okay, that's John's Gospel. He says there were 5,000 people there. So this crowd is enormous. And the disciples get to Jesus, and they advise, and they say, you know what, Jesus, it's getting late. I know that they appreciate hearing you preach, and the reality is they'd stay all night. But we need to think about their needs too, and they need to go back into town and buy them food. It's time to dismiss them. It's time to say, go home, get some rest, and I'll meet you back in the morning. Right? And Jesus says, why don't you feed them? And the disciples say, that's nuts. Right? The disciples say, well, look, Jesus, it would take 6 months' wages or more to buy enough bread for these people. We can't afford to feed them. So Jesus says, right, you've heard the story before. Jesus says, well, what have you got? And one of the disciples pipes up, look, all right, some kid's got his lunch, 5 loaves and a couple of fish. Right? We don't know where they came from. Maybe he was sent in a market by his mother to buy the food. Maybe he was on a journey and passing through and saw Jesus and followed him, and that food was supposed to sustain him on his journey. Maybe it really was just his lunch his mom packed for him. I don't know what happened. But for whatever reason, this kid's got 5 loaves and 2 fish. Now, there's a lot this kid could say, right? I came prepared. You didn't. Leave me alone. Right? But he doesn't. The disciples ask for it. He gives it. Jesus says, give everybody as much as they want, and then just give them as much as they want and then move on to the next person. Right, so if you're a disciple, you're thinking, Jesus makes some really ridiculous requests. But this one's easy, because I don't actually have to feed 5,000 people, I only have to feed one. If you have one serving of food, and you give everybody enough, as much as they want, the first person's going to eat it all, and we're going to be done, right? So this is pretty easy. So they go, and they feed, and it keeps going, and it keeps going, and it keeps going. Before long, they fed 5,000 people till they're full. Jesus says, we don't want to waste anything. go collect the leftovers, and they have 12 baskets left over. This miracle is extraordinary, and there's a lot of really important components to it. Jesus is, of course, the main character here. He is the one who authored this miracle by the power of God, but it was through the willingness of the young boy to serve that it was made possible. Now, God doesn't need our permission to be God, but God has demonstrated throughout the Old and New Testament his desire to work through his creation, his desire to use us to make good things happen. And in much the same way, it was his desire not to make the food come out of thin air. It was his desire to use the gifts of someone in the crowd and then to stretch that gift so that it was enough, right? This is important. So the young boy is our everyday hero for today, whose name we don't even know and will never know. He is the unknown soldier of this incredible victory. This young boy has 5 loaves and 2 fish, and he gives it willingly, right? He gives it up. There's no story, there's no recollection in any of the 4 Gospels that he fought about it, right? In fact, he's not even mentioned in the other Gospels. They just say that they had it. Only John was kind enough to even mention that he existed. The others just said that they had the food. Imagine what it might mean to be the person who got the ball rolling on one of the most extraordinary miracles in the Bible, and 3 out of 4 don't even remember you existed, and the other one can't remember your name, right? But I don't think it would have mattered much, because this young boy didn't do what he did for recognition. This young boy did what he did because Jesus was there. Again, I don't know. I'm making this up completely. Here's your disclaimer. I don't know where the food came from. But I have had to guess. The story I like the best is the idea that maybe his mother sent him to market to buy the food, or maybe he was on a journey and had the food with him. And as he's going to wherever it is he's going, he sees Jesus, and he follows him because he wants to hear what he has to say. And Jesus says, I need something from you, and he says, here it is, Jesus, you've got it. I love the idea of that being one possibility of what might have happened before the story started, because it's in a conversion story, isn't it? It's a story of a young man seeing and following Jesus and then giving everything he's got to Jesus. Again, I don't know because the Bible doesn't tell us what exactly happened before the story happened, but something did. And there was some moment where this young man did 2 things. He sought Jesus out, right? Jesus didn't go into the town knocking on doors asking people to come to church. He stood on a shore and people came to him. So he sought Jesus out. The second thing he did is he gave everything he had. Now, according to the well-known church researcher Tom Rainer, I quote him a lot. He works for Lifeway. He's a researcher who just basically asks questions of people who go to church. And that's kind of what he does for a full-time job. And he asked why people don't give. He asked people, you know, people who don't give, whether it's financially or they don't give their time or they don't, you know, they don't contribute to the church. Maybe they don't even come to church, right? He's asking people who don't contribute what their reasons are. And he got a lot of answers, right? A very common one being that they simply couldn't afford to, right? And that's tough. But he got a few that were interesting to me when I read this list. I expected the number one to be, you know, that they simply couldn't afford it, but it actually wasn't. That was like number 9. Number 1 actually was that they didn't trust the church. That surprised me. But at the same time, it didn't surprise me. You know what I mean? Either it was somebody in the church they didn't trust, or it was a decision made years ago that they decided that they didn't like that decision, that they didn't use the money the way they wanted to. Right? We say we give it to God, but frequently we don't actually mean that. Right? This is my payment to control the church as opposed to my gift to God. And if it isn't used the way I want it to be used, I'm going to be upset and not give anymore. And then another reason that was really common was, well, of course, they didn't trust people in the church, they didn't trust the pastor, they didn't trust whatever. Another reason was that they felt like it wouldn't make a difference, that their gift was too small and insignificant. Well, one of the things that I've mentioned before is the difficulty of churches to reach people who aren't like them. How many of our churches, and this is statistically backed up, a great number of our churches, the folks on average tend to make more than the folks in the community. Now, a lot of times that's touted as a good thing, like look what networking in church gets you, but maybe I'm too cynical, but I look at it the other way around. Why aren't we reaching the low-income people? Why aren't we reaching the people who really need to know what peace comes from Jesus? So a lot of them feel like it won't make a difference. One thing Tom Rainer found, for example, is that people assumed the church had more than the reality was. Whether it was money or time, they assumed they had more volunteers, they assumed they had plenty of help for an event, they assumed they had plenty of money, they had plenty of whatever, and that often wasn't the reality. And, of course, way down the list was a belief that they couldn't afford it. I once heard a preacher say, if you wait till you give until you can afford it, you'll never give. But there are a lot of ways to give, time, talents, and treasure. And, of course, there are many of us who in our lives are not in a position where we're ready to give, but it's not the church that we answer to for that, it's God. Our unknown hero of this story gave not because he lacked any fear. He lacked any fear of what giving might mean. In his case, it was food. It was what he had with him. When we talk about giving, we're not just talking about money. We're talking about our willingness to serve the church by serving God. So he didn't give because he didn't have any fear. He gave because he had an abundance of faith. He expected God to do something extraordinary if he was willing to give up what he had. When we look at the Bible, we should be asking questions. Questions like, what is the author teaching me today? What does God want me to take away from this story? The story, like many in the Bible, is short, and it's easy to gloss over, but I believe the most important takeaway is what happens when the people of God respond in faith to give themselves to God. Instead of hoarding together our desire to fix everything ourselves, we give ourselves to God, not just hoping, but here's the important part, expecting that God will do good in our lives. I think that's the real challenge when it comes to our willingness to serve, our willingness to give, our willingness to give up things that separate us from God, is that we think that hoping God will do something good is enough, and it's not. We've got to expect it. The Scripture tells us that this is going to happen. God tells us that this is going to happen. So hoping it is a lack of faith. That might sound strange, but hoping that God will do good is a lack of faith. Faith says God will absolutely do good. Faith is an expectation that God will do good, right? So if we have an expectation that God is going to do good in our lives, if we do what God asks us to do, if we give as God asks us to give, if we serve as God asks us to give, and we have faith that God will return tenfold, that God will take our little bitty gift, our insignificant gift that we think will never make a difference, right? That was like second on the list. That God will take our little bitty gift and feed 5,000 people with it. That God will take our little bitty bit of free time that we give to the church and will do extraordinary things with it. If we expect that to happen, how does that change the way that we give? How does that change the way that we serve? Because what God can do with a little, God could do even more with a lot, right? What if we shifted from hoping to expecting? Now, I don't know the motivations of the young man. I can guess, but we don't know anything about him. He's the unknown hero. We know nothing about him. One of the things that I thought was interesting about the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier that I actually didn't know until this week is that the Medal of Honor is awarded to each person who's buried there. Now, the Medal of Honor is an honor. It's the greatest military honor that the United States can give anybody. By the way, these unknown soldiers were also given honors from all over the world. The original one, for example, received the Victoria Cross from England and a number of honors from other allied nations. And even decades later, continued to receive honors and awards from the military and from other militaries around the world. But we don't know what they did. We have no idea what happened. If we knew that, we knew who they were, wouldn't we? We don't know that these were some brave men who threw themselves on a grenade, because if we knew that, we'd know their name. What we do know is that they don't have a name. And that's kind of the reason they're honored so extraordinarily much. Because they gave themselves not for recognition. They gave themselves not for the honor and the glory. They don't even get their own name on their tombstone. This is the ultimate example and image of service when it comes to service to the military, right? That they're buried in the most honored grave in the world, but without their name on it. So it struck me as interesting that they were given all these awards, deservedly so, but they were given the awards not because of what they did, but because of what they didn't do. Because they didn't get the parade. Their family didn't get a funeral. They didn't get their name in the hometown paper. They didn't get a highway named after them. Their name died with them. All their family knows is that they're missing in action. Somewhere there's a family with a telegraph that says your loved one is missing in action, who turns out is the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers first interred. But they'll never know that. I am encouraged by the faith of the young boy, because he did what he did even though nobody was going to tell his story. We know what happened next. We know Jesus' story, but we know nothing about him except that John takes the time to mention the food came from a kid. End of story. He did what he did not for recognition. He did what he did not to get his name out there. He did what he did not to leave a legacy, not to put his name on something. He did what he did to honor God. I think the other issue that we have often in giving is our desire to do so for some sort of recognition. We want other people to see us doing good. But would we still do good? Would we still do what God asks us to do if no one would ever knew we did it? That, again, is where we shift from hope to expectation. Hope is infant faith. Hope is, hope leaves open the opportunity for it not to happen, doesn't it? If I hope God will do good, that means there's a chance that he won't. But if I expect God to do good, then he absolutely will. When I expect God to do good, I do it because God will do good. When I hope God will do good, then my contingency plan is even if God doesn't do good, then people will know I did good and they'll feel good about me. We are people who struggle with a lack of faith. That's a truth. It's a truism of Christianity. That's kind of why we're here. It's kind of why we struggle and why we grow. John Wesley was the one who coined the notion of working towards perfection and sanctification, the founder of Methodism, which meant it was working towards that sanctification, working towards that perfection. But we're not there yet. We're not there yet. I said before that my favorite response to street preachers who run up to you and ask if you're saved is, I'm working on it. Because that's what a Wesleyan response to what salvation is. It's a journey that we're on towards sanctification. Now, assurance of salvation is a little bit different, but if you ask me if I'm where God wants me to be, not yet. Every day of my life, I work towards that. So our unknown person of the story gave not because he lacked any fear, but because of his abundance of faith. Our world is starving for miracles. It's also full of unsung and unnamed heroes who enable them. People whose willingness to serve God exists solely for the pleasure of God and not for themselves. They serve God because they want to serve God, because they want God to be rewarded for it. They want God to do good things for it, not because they expect to get something out of it. I am encouraged by the faith of the unnamed youth specifically because he's unnamed. We know nothing about him, but what we do know is his faith. Because the most important legacy we can leave in our lives is our faith. Not our name, not our wealth, not our fashion sense, not our car, right? Most of us don't have any of that cool stuff anyway, right? We don't have very much of it. The most important legacy we leave is our faith. How we impacted the kingdom of God by expecting God to do good with what we had, so we gave everything we had. Whatever that means to you. All of us, myself included, could do more for God if we responded yes to what God asks us to do. I'm encouraged by the faith of the young man because he's unnamed, but his faith is a legacy that lasts for generations. For 2,000 years, Christians have been looking at the faith of the young man and being impressed by what he did because of what Jesus did. Because of the disciples who said, Jesus wants us to feed this crowd with these 5 loaves and these 2 fish, so we're going to do it. And they had 12 baskets left over. The cascading effect of the feeding of the 5,000 was, of course, a miracle of Jesus Christ. But it worked so well because of people being willing to do what God asked them to do, even though it was ridiculous, even though they didn't have enough to give, because they expected God to do good in the midst of it. So, friends, my prayer for us this week is that we would be encouraged by the faith of people that we don't know, the unnamed people, the person in the street who offers a hand, the young boy who offers the last bit of food to feed somebody else. These extraordinary examples of faith that we hear about in our lives every day, even if names aren't attached. Because our everyday heroes that we're going to talk about for the next several weeks, many have names, but many don't. But they're known to God. And their work that they've done has made others known to God. Amen.